Today is September the 29th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Following the release of iOS 15, Apple releases iOS 12.5.5. Seems like it's going backwards, but it's not. There are now over 10.41 billion mobile connections worldwide, which surpasses the current world population of 7.89 billion, implied by the UN digital analyst estimates. This data means that there are 2.52 billion more mobile connections than people worldwide. The highest number of users is China, leading with the most physical smartphone users at 851 million, only due to the population size with close to 60% market penetration. The United States, with a population of 329 million, the number of users totaled 260 million, with a market penetration of 80%. Apple iOS continues to hold down the largest share of the smartphone operating systems market in the United States, claiming more than half of the market in May of 2021. Market share of iOS smartphone shipments globally stood at 14.1% in the second quarter. Since its initial release back in January of 2011, more than 1.9 billion iPhones have been sold. There are many older models of the iPhone still in current use. 63% of all iPhones ever sold are still in use. Apple finally released iOS 15. Surprisingly, iOS 15 is compatible with every iPhone and iPod Touch model that currently runs on iOS 14. This means that iPhone 6S users and later as well as 7th generation iPod Touch users can now install the iOS 15 update. But iOS 15 won't support all older models of iPhone with an A9 chip or earlier. iOS 15 won't support iPhone 6S, iPhone 6S Plus, iPhone SE 1st generation, iPad 5th generation, iPad Mini 4, and the iPad Air 2. However, Apple did not forget those who are still using older models of iPhone. Apple just rolled out iOS 12.5.5. Apple, in June of 2021, introduced the latest version of the iOS operating system, iOS 15, which was released just recently, September the 20th. iOS 15 introduces new features for FaceTime calls, tools to reduce distractions, a new notifications experience, added privacy features, and complete redesigns for Safari, weather, and maps, and more. Apple is also rolling out iOS 12.5.5 to older iPhone and iPad models. The company says the update includes notable security fixes and improvements and is recommended for all users. The update is available for the iPad Air, the iPad Mini 2, and the iPad Mini 3, as well as the 6th generation iPad Touch, iPhone 5S, iPhone 6, and iPhone 6 Plus. All of these devices were dropped from support with iOS 13, but Apple has continued to update them with important security fixes since then. Apple has previously rolled out iOS 12.5.4 in June with security fixes for WebKit vulnerabilities and other issues. This update provides important security updates and is recommended for all users, Apple says in a release note for iOS 12.5.5. Apple instructs users to visit its security updates website for more information about what's new in iOS 12.5.5. One of the new features in iOS 15 is FaceTime on Android. FaceTime app could only be used by Apple-owned devices, but now an Android user can join the FaceTime video chat with their respective Android device with a shareable link. Apple's new iOS 15 software added this feature and will allow Apple users to send an invitation to an Android user. You follow these steps to use FaceTime on Android smartphones. First, an Apple user needs to create a link and have to choose how they want to share the link, via email, text, Snapchat, etc. Once the link is received by the Android users, they have to open the link using Google Chrome app on their smartphone. Once Google Chrome is open, and the Android user will be asked to enter their respective name and then will be asked to press Continue option. Next step requires Android user to press on the Join button from the pop-up option on the screen. After the completion of these three steps, Apple user is required to accept the request to join from the person using the Android smartphone. And last, both the parties are in the same FaceTime core, and the Android user will be able to use the app like an iPhone user. Duel, which is similar to FaceTime for the Android, is available on both iPhones and iPads. When you sign up, you'll get a verification code on your phone. Download and install Duel, and then verify your phone number. Now you have the capability to use FaceTime for iPhone and Android user, or you can use Duel with the iPhone and Android user. Is VPN safe to use? Well, before we can answer that, what is VPN and how does it work? In simple terms, a VPN, or virtual private network, is a tool that allows establishing a secure connection to other systems on the internet. This service hides your IP address from others and encrypts personal information, so your data isn't tracked online by governments, hackers, or even advertisers. A VPN usually acts by hiding your personal device's IP address and routing the internet connection through a VPN server. With a VPN, your internet service provider, that's the ISP, can't see the content you're sending or receiving. What is one feature that a good VPN provider should have? A good VPN provider must be able to guarantee all its users with a no-logs policy and ideally have that policy independently audited to leave no doubts about the privacy of its users. Most of the VPN providers also say they offer top-notch security, and their answer to the question, is VPN safe, is always positive. However, it's highly recommended that every user gets familiar with all the features and options of the VPN. Using a VPN service will slow your internet speed down. Is VPN safe to use? The quick, short answer is yes. Unless, of course, you select a VPN provider that is not very trustworthy. While a VPN doesn't hide the actual IP address from your ISP, because you're using your primary IP address to connect to a VPN, the data you send or receive is well hidden. Your ISP can only see that you're using a VPN connection to interact with a different network in another country. That's it. Well, what are the main dangers of a VPN? No matter how trusted and secure all the top providers are, there are still so many options out there that it's easy to get caught by choosing the wrong one. In spite of the promise for privacy, security, and anonymity given by the majority of VPN apps, millions of users may be unaware or subject to poor security guarantees and abusive practices inflicted by VPN apps. Can a VPN be hacked? The answer is a short and forward yes. Everything can get hacked, and VPNs are no exception. Since all the data on trusted VPN servers is encrypted, hackers would either need somehow steal the encryption key or to break the encryption system of a VPN. The latter would be possible if hackers found out the vulnerabilities of a particular VPN service. Having a VPN is much safer than not having it. You're more likely to be hacked or tracked while using your primary IP address. There are free VPN services. However, safety issues and information tracking is important to know first. VPN services, of course, always want to make money. And since they cannot generate any revenue from selling their product, they usually sell their customers' personal information. When someone goes through a free VPN service to browse the internet and, for example, logs on to some social media account, their information goes to the provider's hands. You can't call a VPN hack, technically speaking, but usually users just hand out their personal information to the provider themselves. This is how many VPN services were proven to be untrustworthy. Most of them are using this scheme to make money and sell the customer's sensitive information. Some providers can sell personal data, collect your online banking details, and then even steal your money. Don't ever think using any online banking services while you're browsing through a free VPN service. Then there's the issue of ownership of VPN services. How many are aware that Facebook owns a VPN company? Since the Facebook acquisition of Onavo, that's O-N-A-V-O, it was frequently classified as being spyware, as the VPN was used to monetize application usage data collected within an allegedly private-focused environment. In August of 2018, Facebook pulled Onavo Protect from the iOS App Store due to violations of Apple's policies forbidding apps from collecting data on the usage of other apps. In February of 2019, in response to criticism over Facebook market research program employing similar techniques, including, in particular, being targeted towards teens, Onavo announced that it would sunset the Android version of Protect as well. The social media giant first acquired Onavo back in 2013 for close to $200 million with the aim of using its VPN service to secretly gather data about how consumers use their smartphones. Facebook then released an app called Onavo Project, which Apple banned from the App Store for collecting and reporting usage data. As a result of the controversy surrounding its Onavo Protect, Facebook then began to refer to its research app as Project Atlas, which it used to continue collecting user data in blatant disregard to Apple's policies. In order to get users to install its research app on their smartphones, the company decided to pay them up to $20 per month. However, it was later discovered that in addition to adults, Facebook had also been paying teenagers to install the app. When TechCrunch broke the story and Apple issued a ban, though the social media company claimed it had removed the app voluntarily. I asked this question at the beginning of the program. Can a big tech program offer a trustworthy VPN? Well, you got the facts and you decide. Hey Joe, what VPN are you using and do you have any comments to make about it?
I've been hearing a lot lately about security and hackers and people breaking in and identity theft and all this sort of stuff. And it's enough to scare you out of ever using anything about your smartphone or laptop online. I did a little personal survey yesterday. I was at the Subaru dealer, and they featured in their waiting room free Wi-Fi. So I asked two or three of the young guys who were working on their laptops which VPN, virtual private network, were they using. Neither of them were using one. Last week, I was at the hospital for a checkup, and in the waiting room, they had a sign saying, "Guests, feel free to use the guest Wi-Fi." And there was one young man who was using it, and I asked, "Which VPN do you use?" He didn't use one either. Two out of all the possible checkups I did are not valid. But I started to think, and I asked my wife, I asked a couple of her friends, none of them are using VPNs. My next-door neighbor is a fairly sophisticated user, and I asked which one he used. He uses the same one that I use. Why? I asked him, and he said, well, I started using it a couple of years ago, and it was the highest rated, and I saw no reason to change. And I stopped and thought about it, and I had the same reason for using it. So I went in on the net to see if it was still the highest rated. It was very highly rated, but it was also perhaps the most expensive one out there. One of the things that the VPN does not do, my VPN does not do, is it does not block malicious advertising. It puts everything into a secure usage. It doesn't block ads. So I started doing some research on that, and I found that three of the top-rated VPNs do have ad blockers built in. If you stop and look at the amount of spam that I get, written spam, email spam, telephone spam, that became a rather important feature to me. But what was the most important feature? Well, I wanted to have their servers in a country where our government in Washington could not demand access. I wanted to have a company that kept no logs, so even if they were hacked by the CIA, they would have no information about me. I wanted to have a company that had so many servers that its speed was unaffected, no matter how many people were using it at the same time that I was. And I found that this kind of review online was available. I'm not going to tell you which one I use, because every individual has their own specific needs for a VPN. The important thing to do is read up about them, find out what different things each individual VPN offers, and then make a choice based upon your needs. But remember, it's now much more competitive than it was when I first started using ExpressVPN. That one is still a very highly rated one, but it's probably the most expensive one out there. I've found that people like McAfee and people you've never heard of all have wonderful VPNs. They're competing with each other, so some of them have gotten down to $24 a year. Some have gotten lower than that. Some of them are higher, but they're offering special things. Pick your VPN carefully, very carefully, because it's so important that you have protection for what you do online.
Thanks, Joe, for your insight. It is reported the White House may use the Defense Production Act to start solving the logjam of semiconductor chips that's hitting car manufacturing and other industries in various sectors. The U.S. government isn't going to use the Defense Production Act to force companies to start making chips. Commerce Secretary is asking for information about how many chips companies actually need, as well as details on how many chips they might be hoarding. Since early 2020, chip manufacturers have increased output by 8%, and it will increase 16% by the end of 2022, according to the Semiconductor Industry Association. When the pandemic first started, prominent economists predicted there would be a drop in demand for automobiles. So, what do you think many of the car manufacturers did? Many of the car manufacturers either dropped or slashed their order for semiconductor chips. And when they got back into the queue, the chip foundries were fulfilling other orders. The ongoing semiconductor chip shortage that's affecting production of high-tech products around the world continues to make building new cars difficult for the automotive industry. The administration might start taking unusual steps to try and solve the issue. The White House is considering a possible solution that involves a Defense Production Act, which was put into place in 1950 during the Korean War. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, that's FEMA, which exercises the Defense Production Act, called DPA, calls it the primary source of presidential authorities to expedite and expand the supply of materials and services from the United States industrial base needed to promote the national defense. In this case, according to Bloomberg News, the president might invoke the DPA in order to ease some of the supply chain disruptions that have caused the industry to build millions fewer new vehicles than originally planned. Commerce Secretary asked industry representatives for information regarding the number of chips these companies have on hand, as well as how many they need or want to purchase. The reason the government wants to know these details is twofold. First, it wants a better understanding of whether or not the automakers are hoarding any chips. Second, it wants to know exactly how many chips are needed. Since there are reports that automakers are placing chip orders with the semiconductor manufacturers that are larger than what they actually need to build new cars, since they don't expect the chip makers to actually deliver the full orders. So basically, the government wants to understand just how bad the crisis really is. The Commerce Secretary told Bloomberg News the following. What I told them is I don't want to have to do anything compulsory, but if they don't comply, then they'll leave me no choice. She said that they're evaluating all the options right now, all the tools. And she hopes not to go there, but what she said was we need to see some progress and we definitely need compliance. The Semiconductor Industry Association said semiconductor factories around the world have increased production by 8% since the first few months of 2020 and will increase production by more than 16% by the end of 2022. Other government actions that could alleviate the chip shortage, but not anytime soon, which includes $52 billion in federal subsidies that would boost domestic semiconductor manufacturing. That legislation to provide this money, supported by the White House, has passed in the Senate, but not the House of Representatives. These funds would be used to build chip foundries, which, with most optimistic estimates, would be a minimum of 18 months. This would not alleviate the near-term chip shortage. Automobile manufacturers have had to maintain a certain reserve of chips for car maintenance. This is not hoarding. Car manufacturers make more money using the chips to sell new cars. Maintaining an allotment of chips in reserve for maintenance is dead money. The semiconductor foundries are broken down and set up each time when different semiconductors are manufactured for different clients in different industries. The foundries are set up to produce chips in the order that they are received. If the government injects itself to setting priorities for who is next in line to have their chip order manufactured, there will be chaos with the electronics industry. Car manufacturers use legacy chips, and computer manufacturers are using high-end chip design. As many of us experience in real life, using the method of triage is tantamount to not knowing when you are next in line. European Union proposes mandatory USB-C on all devices, including iPhones, with the aim of reducing e-waste. Well, I can understand that. I have many chargers and there's so many different connectors on it. I just have one wire for one device and another wire for another device. I would like to see one universal wire, but the mandate that every device has a USB-C, that might inhibit inventing a new or different and more efficient connector. The European Commission, the executive arm of the European Union, has announced plans to force smartphone and other electronics manufacturers to fit a common USB-C charging port on their devices. The proposal is likely to have the biggest impact on Apple, which continues to use its proprietary Lightning connector rather than the USB-C connector adopted by most of its competitors. The rules are intended to cut down on, of course, electronic waste by allowing people to reuse existing chargers and cables when they buy new electronics. In addition to phones, the rules will apply to other devices like tablets, headphones, portable speakers, video game consoles, and cameras. Can you imagine you buy a cordless headphone and you gotta have a USB-C adapter on it to connect to what? Well, you'll probably say it's to charge the built-in battery. But with cordless charging being developed, would it still be necessary to have USB-C? Manufacturers will also be forced to make their fast charging standards interoperable and to provide information to customers about what charging standards their device supports. Under the proposal, customers will be able to buy new devices without an included charger. The proposal only covers devices using wired, not wireless, chargers. EU Commissioner said in a press conference, adding that there's plenty of room for innovation on wireless. To become law, the revised Radio Equipment Directive proposal would need to pass a vote in the European Parliament. If adopted, manufacturers will eventually have 24 months to comply with the new rules. The Parliament has already voted in favor of new rules on a common charger in early 2020, indicating that the proposal should have broad support. Chargers power all our most essential electronic devices. With more and more devices, more and more chargers are sold that are not interchangeable or not necessary. We are putting an end to that, said the Commissioner of the European Union. With our proposal, European consumers will be able to use a single charger for all their portable electronics, an important step to increase convenience and reduce wear. I don't know. Are they going to force this also on power tools? European consumers were frustrated long enough about incompatible chargers piling up in their drawers. They gave the industry plenty of time to come up with their own solution. Now time is ripe for legislative action for a common charger. What they proposed was a common charger for mobile phones and other similar electronic devices. A single charger will be more convenient for people and will reduce electronic waste. The proposals focus on the charging port on the device end, but the Commission says it eventually hopes to ensure full interoperability on both ends of the cable. The power supply end will be addressed in a review to be launched at a later date this year. The proposals follow a vote in the European Parliament in January of 2020 when lawmakers voted for new rules on common chargers. As of 2016, the amount of electronic waste produced across the bloc amounted to around 12.3 million metric tons. The biggest impact of the new rules is likely to be felt by Apple, which continues to ship phones with a Lightning connector as opposed to the increasingly universal USB-C port. As of 2018, around 29% of phone chargers sold in the European Union use the USB-C, 21% use Lightning, and around half use the older micro USB standard. According to a European Union assessment reported by Reuters, these proportions are likely to have shifted considerably as USB-C has replaced micro USB across all but the least expensive Android phones. Efforts to get smartphone manufacturers to use the same charging standard in the EU dates back to 2009 when Apple, Samsung, Huawei, and Nokia signed a voluntary agreement to use a common standard. In the following years, the industry gradually adopted micro USB and more recently USB-C as a common charging port. However, despite reducing the amount of charging standards from over 30 down to just 3, in other words, USB-C, micro USB, and Lightning, regulators have said this voluntary approach has fallen short of its objectives. Apple was a notable outlier in that it never included a micro USB port on its phones directly. Instead, it offered a micro USB to a 30-pin adapter. It also voiced its opposition to the latest round of attempts to settle on a single charging standard. In a statement released last year, Apple said new rules risk creating e-waste because people may have to throw out the existing Lightning accessories if they're incompatible with universal standard. And that regulation could stifle innovation by forcing companies to stick to current ports. Although it's continued to use Lightning, Apple has made its own efforts to reduce charger e-waste. Last year, it stopped shipping charging bricks or earbuds in the box with new iPhones
and supplied them only with a Lightning to USB-C cable. However, the move was met with a mixed response, with some arguing that it helped Apple's bottom line more than the environment. While European lawmakers focus mainly on wired chargers, wireless charging is becoming increasingly popular across smartphones and has largely converged on a single cross-platform standard. QI, that's QI, there have even been rumors that Apple could ship an iPhone without a Lightning port and have it rely entirely on wireless charging for power. If anyone have any thoughts on it, I'd like to hear what some of your thoughts are. This is Hank Key at PCRadioshow.org if you have any to opine about. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series, Ageism Ponderings.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we set aside a little bit of time to talk about the workplace and technology and how it's all changing. It's kind of an interesting thing. I am a digital native. What is a digital native? It is somebody who basically grew up with computers. We typically associate this with some of the millennials. We definitely, consider this, some of these newer generations. Yes, they're definitely digital natives. I technically am a Gen X that identifies more as a baby boomer that is a digital native. Before I was a preteen when, I think I was under 10 when I took my first. Yeah, it was somewhere in there. A preteen, about 10 years old, maybe 12 years old, when I first took a computer course. And I have been dealing with computers and technology on a professional basis for most of my life. I've been immersed in all of this technical culture from before we had things commonplace like DOS, before we had things like, oh yes, Windows, or ooh, smartphones. Yes, I go all the way back. So when we start talking about my experience in IT, my experience with the entire technical culture, I am a nerd. I fully embrace this, and I have for my entire career. I am a computer nerd. One of those self-identifiers. I use that self-identifier only in second place to one thing, and that is that I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian first. I'm a computer nerd second, and then we start getting into, oh yes, I'm married and I have a kid and stuff like that. But no offense to them, it's just how the world works out. But my wife loves me in spite of that. Because of that. No, it was something like that. Anyways, so here's the thing that comes along with this. The fact that I am in my, I'm starting to breach into the mid-50 range. From the early 50s to the mid-50s, you get an idea roughly of how old I am. I have been encountering ageism. And it is something that I think the world needs to kind of readjust. And I think they need to think about the whole way we treat ageism, the whole way we treat age in the workplace, especially when we start talking about technology. One of the interesting areas, and I've talked about this in the past, and I'm going to relate this back to age. I deal with something called change management. This is my regular professional role with the company that I work for right now. It is me saying, yes, it's great you're going to make this patch, this change, this software change, hardware change, whatever it is, except you need to make sure you do this or that. You need to double check this. You need to double check that. And a lot of these different things come from not because I learned how to do change management, but because I learned how to not make these mistakes some 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Yes, that's right. Sometimes, once in a while, I have a story which I can give to somebody and I can say, look, this is why you need to dot your I's, cross your T's, and make sure that your change is going to work properly. Because way back when, there was this one guy who didn't check this checkbox, or there was this one person who went through this one lady, whatever it is, and they decided to make an upgrade in the middle of the day, taking down a server that 300 people were on. You know, and these stories here don't really relate a whole lot to this, but it's a matter of that experience. It's that whole lifetime of experiences that allow me to excel. It's that wisdom to know when not to move forward, to know that technology is not perfect and neither are the people who are implementing technology. And we forget that. We think about all of these cool certificates and, oh, yes, this person knows this particular technology forwards and backwards. They have they have this certificate and that certificate, and they've got this knowledge and that knowledge, and they've been working with this for however long, and so much of what I apply is common sense to an industry which lacks at times that common sense. Sure, they've got exuberance. Sure, they've got that whole idea of let's go and let's dive in, let's do this, and we'll just deal with whatever happens when it happens. And the reality is, so many of these problems can be predicted. And this is just me. This is just one area where my age and my experience are definitely miles ahead. And they're able to protect whatever is going on with these changes, with the office, with the company, and they allow us to move forward safely. There are other areas, I'm sure, but unfortunately, we keep thinking about technology as being a young person's game, and that there's no room for old people, and it really couldn't be further from the truth. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The computer chip industry and Catch-22. A Catch-22 is a problem for which the only solution is denied by a circumstance inherent in the problem or by a rule. The computer chip industry has a dirty climate secret. As demand for chips surges, the semiconductor industry is trying to grapple with its huge carbon footprint. Demand is booming for silicon chips, but it comes at a big cost, a huge carbon footprint. Meeting global climate goals will, in part, rely on semiconductors. They're integral to electric vehicles, solar arrays, and wind turbines. But chip manufacturing also contributes to the climate crisis. It requires huge amounts of energy and water. A chip fabrication plant, or fab, or foundry, whatever you want to call it, can use millions of gallons of water a day and creates hazardous waste. As the semiconductor industry finds itself increasingly under the spotlight, it is starting to grapple with its climate impacts. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, the world's largest chip maker, pledged to reach net zero emissions by 2050. But decarbonizing the industry will be a big challenge. Taiwan Semiconductor alone uses almost 5% of all Taiwan's electricity, and it is predicted to rise to 7.2% in 2022. And as I had noted previously, Taiwan Semiconductor plans to create a couple more semiconductor foundries in Arizona. That will only add to the problem of water that is in short supply right now. Taiwan Semiconductor used about 63 metric tons of water in 2019. The company's water use became a controversial topic during Taiwan's drought this year, the country's worst in a half century, which pitted chip makers against farmers. In the United States, a single foundry, that's Intel's 700-acre campus in Ocotillo, Arizona, produced nearly 15,000 tons of waste in the first 3 months of this year, and about 60% of it is hazardous. It also consumed 927 million gallons of fresh water and used 561 million kilowatt hours of energy. Chip manufacturing, rather than energy consumption or hardware use, accounts for most of the carbon output from electronics devices. A global shortage of high-end chips as the pandemic boosted demand for electronics and COVID outbreaks closed fabs has increased focus on the industry. In an attempt to increase production, many countries are embarking on big programs to boost the industry. The Chips for America Act proposes $52 billion in funding over 5 years for the U.S. semiconductor industry. The European Union has forwarded its own legislation aimed at increasing its share of the global chip market to 20% by 2030. These ambitions line up a potential clash with the international climate goals. Both the European Union and the United States aim to get halfway to net zero carbon emission by 2030 and to net zero by 2050. As the semiconductor industry grows, so too will its carbon footprint. The semiconductor business is ramping up action on tackling its climate footprint. Greater availability of renewable energy is helping chip makers reduce their carbon footprint. Intel made a commitment to source 100% of its energy from renewable sources by 2030, as did Taiwan Semiconductor, but with a deadline of 2050. Energy consumption accounts for 62% of Taiwan Semiconductor's emissions. The company signed a 20-year deal last year with a Danish energy firm, Ørsted, buying all the energy from a 920-megawatt offshore wind farm that Ørsted is building in the Taiwan Strait. The deal, which has been described as the world's largest corporate renewables purchase agreement, has benefits for Taiwan Semiconductor. As well as guaranteeing a clean electricity supply, it pays a wholesale cost and removes itself from the price shocks. Taiwan Semiconductor's actions have the potential to influence the rest of the industry. Other manufacturers are likely to follow its lead. As well as switching to renewables, chip makers could also implement efficiencies in fabs. A chip fab is basically a gigantic warehouse with a clean room inside. That's the easy part of the facility itself. Fabs could be more efficient in regulating air and water temperature, humidity, and pressure. They could segment warehouses so one production line had high pressure and another lower, using less energy than keeping the entire warehouse at a high pressure. They could capture more data and use machine learning to turn tools off when they weren't being used. There is also innovation aimed at tackling the worst polluting materials used in making semiconductors. The chip industry uses different gases during the production process, many of which have a significant climate impact. Taiwan Semiconductor said it had implemented scrubbers and other facilities to treat gas emissions, but another route is replacing dirtier cleaning gases that clean the delicate tools in semiconductor manufacturing. In industrial tests over the last 6 years, about a half dozen chip makers had replaced more polluting gases with cleaner fluorine with a lower global warming impact. Other companies targeted the gases that are used to etch patterns onto and clean the silicon surface of a wafer, the thin piece of material used to make semiconductors. But replacing gases will be a challenge. Anything that touches the silicon wafer, such as an etching gas, is really hard to alter once a fab is operating. The process involves a huge amount of precision. It takes 4 to 5 years for fabs to develop a recipe for this, and once you set it, you basically never want to change it. Some experts believe chip makers will start to modify their processes to incorporate greener gases. To some observers of the chip business, the determination to clean up the industry seems real. The vast demand for chips at the moment will only help the semiconductor industry embrace sustainability goals. they have very good operating margins. So even though all these green carbon measures would have a cost, the chip makers can afford it. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Miscellaneous products.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. Marty Winston is back from his journeys all around, well, the world and beyond for this week. So Marty, you've got all kinds of different things that that you have on your list of reviews.
I've been collecting reviewables into an avalanche on my desktop.
Oh, wow. Okay. So,
and I bought a notebook so I could actually do work elsewhere.
Nice.
I should show you this as long as we're talking about stuff. I got rid of my old Samsung phone and got a Google Pixel 5.
Okay.
And I absolutely love it. It is, of course, in an OtterBox case. You know my ages-old belief. There are every kind of case you'd want to get, and then there's OtterBox. Nothing else is OtterBox, so that's well protected. Google Pixel 5, by the way, I got based on the unnatural, irrational assumption that if the authors of Android had hardware, they might take extra early steps to help compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if Microsoft had an operating system and also sold hardware. I can see the opportunity for making things work better, and someday they both will.
Okay.
All right. Well, here's first up. Speaking of phones.
Yeah.
The challenge of knowing exactly where the camera is and where you should look. Mm-hmm. Was met by a product called Eyelines. I will spell that E-Y-E like I, boink, L-I-N-E-Z, eyelines.com.
Okay.
And you can see, because you have the ability to look over my shoulder, the tiny stickers that are in rings that go around the camera lens on your webcam or your notebook or your phone or whatever. Eyelines, you can stare at these. They've got all kinds of designs. In case you don't want to look at a frog, you can look at a donut.
Okay, so let me describe that for the listeners. It's a circle with multiple lines moving in. Think of eyelashes, although they've got other designs. So like Marty's showing me one, which is looks like eyeballs and a mouth kind of off to the side, the donuts. There you go. There's the donuts.
Hungry.
Frosted donuts. Yes, I am hungry. There's smiley faces. So that would really help for taking pictures of the little kids. Look at the smiley face here and stuff like that. So, yeah.
And that's Eyeline. So the first of a long line.
It's an interesting product, but it seems rather simple. What is the price point on something like that?
I never ask.
You never ask. Okay. So, I can see there's some innovation. They are solving a problem. So I like that.
Yeah, it's not bad. And speaking of having no problems, that's when you watch TV. And ONN has a new casting plugin for Android systems.
Okay.
It plugs in the HDMI port. It's really what? How do I explain this? The picture on the box is actual size for the device inside.
Okay.
And that makes it about the size of as much hot dog as you can hold in your fist.
Okay. All right. Yeah. 3-4 inches long and about that size in volume. So tell me about the platform. Is it quick and speedy, or is that?
It's full HD, which is one of the hallmarks. It goes to all the usual places that, you know, if you got a Roku, where the Roku goes.
Like I have a Fire Stick from their first generation Fire Stick. And years ago, it was nice. It was quick. It was speedy. Today, it is slow as molasses. Except molasses would win that race, I think. So,
well, yeah. if you have decent Wi-Fi,
which is,
and your phone's not handicapped in some way, you're going to get full frame rate HD on this. Will it pixelate? I don't know. You're watching Sesame Street. It might do it there.
So what are the apps that are on that? So it can, I presume that it will do.
Well, they're showing the usual stuff. I mean, Hulu? What's important about it is Dolby audio comes through.
Nice, okay.
They're showing Netflix, YouTube, Peacock, ESPN, Disney Plus, Stars, Paramount Plus, Google Play.
Is Hulu on there?
HBO Max, YouTube, Hulu.
There we go. Okay.
Google Play and the ever famous thousands more.
Thousands more. Yeah. Yes, we're familiar with that one. I presume that it does not have Amazon Prime, which is a problem which a number of companies have had.
You asked if it has Amazon, and it's not on the logos, but I would bet if you've got the login, it's going to take you there.
Yeah, it's so many companies have had problems with all the way from Apple to whoever. I think Apple TV is one of the few products that carries Amazon Prime, which is unfortunate. But
indeed. I mean, I've been watching it. I'm waiting for ever so many series to come back.
There are so many different streaming services that are out there that, you know, it's not like there's a lack of selection. It's not like there's, you know, if you miss one of those services because you've got thousands more, as you mentioned.
In any given week, there's probably enough to watch for a lifetime, unless you insist on watching in 3D and then you're done in a weekend.
I haven't heard anybody mention 3D TV in years, and that's a good thing.
Well, we'll mention 3D in our next segment.
There we go.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 1st, at 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Their website is acgnj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, October the 7th at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is wpcug.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, October the 8th. Meeting time, 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website, limac.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation, Aging in Place with Dr. Alfred Poor, Thursday, October the 14th at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will meet Thursday, October the 28th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.